Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, an interview with Allison Pittmeyer about her new book on the girlzine culture, its history and present. Also, the religious right continues to dominate the conservative discourse on healthcare, and I am finally forced to talk about the Tiger Woods sex scandal. Not that this story is especially new, but a documentary has been made about rape in the military.
Soldiers step into war facing the dangers of combat together, never imagining the enemy would be standing by their side all along.
I was sexually assaulted,
so he held me down and... And I was raped.
Startling figures straight from the U.S. government show one out of three women soldiers are sexually assaulted in the military.
Apparently, the number of reports of rape are soaring upwards as the war drags on. I'm not surprised that this ongoing war with no end in sight is encouraging nihilistically violent male behavior. Hey, 2010! Hope you all had a good vacation. I spent mine catching up on some reading, so it was kind of like work because I read some feminist stuff. But it was older feminist stuff from the 1970s, namely works of the famous pro-sex, pro-pleasure feminist Ellen Willis. There was a quote from an essay she wrote in 1980 that gave me the chills. It was so perceptive. I quote, "The anti-abortion movement is the most dangerous political force in the country. I believe, and in saying this I intend no hyperbole whatsoever, that it is the cutting edge of neo-fascism, a threat not only to women's rights and to everyone's sexual freedom and privacy, but to freedom of religion and civil liberties in general." End quote. What was really interesting was how right Willis was to see that the anti-choice movement was really gearing up to be the front lines in pushing a hardcore right-wing agenda. This has become even more true than she predicted 30 years ago. And really, until this past year, I don't think most liberals saw that. But the murder of Dr. George Tiller, plus the way abortion was used as a Trojan horse strategy against general healthcare reform, put a lot of doubts to rest. What all this means is that the so-called pro-life movement has really played a major role in creating hysteria over healthcare reform, and certainly that didn't slow down much over the holiday. What was interesting was that while abortion was the big anti-choice bullet to shoot at healthcare reform, the death panels thing, like all right-wing memes, was far from dead and made a resurgence. Dick Morris trotted it out on Fox and Friends.
"The Medicare Advisory Board you speak about is a particularly dangerous thing because it's going to set up for Medicare only, for the elderly only, protocols and standards of care, where they're going to be saying, no, you can't give this person a hip replacement, they're too old. And no, you can't treat this person with colon cancer with the best drug available. I know it increases the chance of his dying, but it's beyond the cost parameters that we're prepared to allow. And this will be done by this federal board," which is really the death panel that Sarah Palin was talking about.
This, of course, is an utter lie. It is true that some tumors are so slow-growing that it's better not to put a very old person through chemo who will die of natural causes before the cancer gets to them, but that choice is usually made by doctors. And it's not to save costs, but to not kill someone or ruin someone's last years with chemo. Lies like this get at the weird insinuation that anti-choicers often make, which is that the only reason that there's death at all is that someone screwed up. Not true. It's coming for all of us, and doctors have an obligation not to promise immortality when they can't deliver. Sarah Palin hasn't given up promoting the zombie lie either.
"On the eve of the healthcare reform vote, the ex-governor of Alaska rewrites history on Facebook. Senator Jim DeMint spotted one shocking revelation regarding the section in the bill describing the Independent Medicare Advisory Board, which is a panel of bureaucrats charged with cutting healthcare costs on the backs of patients, also known as rationing. In other words, Democrats are protecting this rationing death panel from future change with a procedural hurdle."
Of course, all this is meant to distract from the fact that the current system is what kills people. By rationing their health care by not offering it at all to people with pre-existing conditions, especially if their employers don't cover it. But I think conservatives get that. They just think if someone poor gets health care, they won't. It's a lot like the way anti-abortion people imagine that if someone else gets away with having sex, they lose out. Not that abortion is going away as a scare tactic by any means. Bart Stupak is doing what wingnuts do best, which is playing the victim, with Fox News offering an assist.
Is the White House putting pressure on a congressman to be quiet? Well, our next guest is a congressman, and he says the answer is yes. But he's telling the White House to take a hike because he's talking to you right here, right now. Congressman Bart Stupak got the pro-life Stupak amendment into the House health care bill, and that amendment would ban taxpayer money from funding any health insurance plan that covers abortion. The Senate came up with an abortion compromise, but many in the pro-life movement says it does not go far enough. Congressman Stupak says the White House gave him a not-so-subtle message. What is that message, and how was it delivered?
Only in the upside-down world of right-wing propaganda is it crazy and wrong and beyond the pale for leaders in a party to try to exert their power on representatives who are flouting the party line. Next week, commentators on Fox News act horrified that politicians who support health care reform continue to get 8 hours of sleep a night, like they not only deserve to live, but also to get rest. I'd like to welcome Allison Piepmeier to the program. Allison runs the Women and Gender Studies program at the College of Charleston, and she's the author of the book Girl Zines, Making Media, Doing Feminism. She's here today to talk about zines, her book, and the third wave of feminism. Welcome to RealityCast, Allison.
Thank you so much.
Okay, let's start with the basics. A lot of the audience wasn't around during the 90s, during the zine revolution, so they may not know what zines are. So what are they, and what did they have to do with feminism in the 90s?
Zines are informal publications, usually photocopied, usually made by just one person who has something to say. They are often very quirky. They can be about any subject matter whatsoever, from, you know, thrift store shopping to your favorite candy. But they're also often about more serious subjects. A lot of girls and women have written zines about sexual abuse, various kinds of experiences of sexism and racism that have occurred in their lives. And zines are deliberately non-professional, deliberately, they sort of operate below the radar. So a lot of listeners may not have heard of them because they're not available through the same kind of venues that, you know, you can't buy a zine on Amazon or at Barnes & Noble. They usually sort of are distributed either through little independent book and music stores or more often person-to-person. So somebody makes a zine, photocopies a bunch of them, keeps them in their backpack, and then hands them to people, friends or folks that they think might enjoy it. But there are tens of thousands of these in production at any given time. I mean, certainly in the 90s, there were estimates of 50,000 in production. But even today, in an age when people often are expressing themselves through blogs, which weren't available in the early 90s. Even today, there are a lot of zines in circulation. It's hard to know exactly how many, again, because they are sort of below the radar. I've had no trouble accessing, getting hundreds of zines in the time that I've been writing this book. It seems to me that once you find out about zines, then you sort of find them everywhere. Even in Charleston, which is not a big city, there are a lot of people producing zines. I've gotten, when people have found out that I have an interest in zines, I've been given lots of zines by Charlestonians, which has been fun.
So what were some of the most prominent zines that you cover in the book?
Well, I interviewed about 15 zine creators who were folks that did zines or are doing zines that have kind of a big circulation or that were fairly influential in the you know, early 90s moment when zines were really, when zines by girls and women were really helping to shape third wave feminism. So there was a zine called Action Girl Newsletter that was made by a woman named Sarah Dyer. And in some ways, Action Girl Newsletter, I argue, was the zine that kind of started the girl zine movement. Sarah was in the punk community and had produced several zines, but had discovered that the zines that she was producing, people interpreted as being by guys. Like, they thought that she, even though on the masthead it would say, "This is my zine, this is mine. It's, you know, people would write to her partner who was doing some of the cartoons as if he was the zine creator. And so she just had this realization that within the punk community where zines were happening, there just wasn't an awareness. There was just sexism. I mean, that is the point here, that she encountered the sexism that she hadn't known was there, and it radicalized her. And so she started seeking out other zines by girls and women, and she created Action Girl Newsletter to publicize those zines. And so Action Girl Newsletter was, was one way that a lot of girls and women found out about other girls and women who were making zines and maybe started making zines of their own. But I also looked at zines that were produced as part of the Riot Girl movement.
The aesthetic of zine feminism has a huge impact on a lot of feminist women my age, from the way we dress to the magnets on our refrigerators. Can you talk some about what that aesthetic was and how it's evolved?
Yeah, so some people have called this like the kitten with a whip or the kinder whore aesthetic, where, you know, it's this kind of mashup. I mean, I think I say in the book that it's a kinder whore, kitten with a whip. It's, a mashup of kind of girlish, like little girlish fashion with a kind of punk aesthetic, particularly in the Riot Girl era. This was a popular style. So people would wear, you know, like Hello Kitty barrettes and baby doll dresses with, you know, Doc Martin combat boots, or, you know, T-shirts that they'd scrawl some sort of really political message on. And you see that in the zines as well as in the kind of personal fashions and, as you're saying, magnets and whatever else. Because, for instance, going back to Sarah Dyer in her Action Girl Newsletter, she always had an image in each newsletter of Hello Kitty wearing a Riot Girl T-shirt and holding a teddy bear that had an anarchist T-shirt on. So it's that kind of, like, playful, sort of creativity with the stuff that defines femininity in our culture. It's like, this is what the culture says that femininity is. And the girls and women who are making zines are often, you know, taking ownership of that and then messing with it in fun, creative ways. And then also in zines, there's just an aesthetic there's a lot of sort of handwriting and drawing and bringing together, images from mainstream media. And again, you know, putting that mainstream media image in the zine and then commenting on it or doing something different with it, making you look at the image in a different way than you might have had you just seen it in a magazine or something. So that's critical commentary on pop culture is really common in these zines.
Well, when I first got into feminist blogging, I really saw it as a way to essentially publish a 90s style zine without actually having to cut and paste and mail stuff.
Yeah.
But it's really changed in the years since I started. And so what are the differences that you see between zines, you know, the old zines and I guess the current zines and the blogs that are out there that are kind of in the similar political vein?
Right. The old zines and the current zines, I mean, in some ways there aren't dramatic differences, except that, you know, perhaps the material, the sort of pop cultural material itself has changed in 15 or 20 years, and so that material is different. Although I don't know that I see dramatic differences in, you know, Cindy Crabb's zine, Dorothy, that she produced 15 years ago, and the one that she's producing today. But I definitely see, you know, I thought a lot about this blog zine connection because in some ways, of course, blogs are the natural, next step. I mean, they are kind of this cultural moment's version of the zine. They have a lot of things in common. Blogs are, again, places that are you know, anybody can have a blog. Anybody can express whatever they want to express on their blog in the same way that, you know, zines are a space that you can express whatever it is that you want to express without any kind of, you know, professional gatekeepers. But, and in the mid-1990s, a lot of people who were in the zine community or who were commenting on zines were saying that, you know, the internet was going to mean the end of zines. I mean, there was a lot of sort of talk about that zines were going to be on their way out. They were going to be this medium that would die. And when I was producing this book, a lot of people thought that, you know, like, oh, you're writing about this sort of historical phenomenon. How quaint. But in fact, you know, zines, as I said, are being produced right now. And many of the zine creators that I interviewed who are doing zines today also have blogs. So it's pretty clear that blogs and zines are similar, but they're not fulfilling the exact same function, because why would you have a zine and a blog if the blog does all the things that the zine does? And so some of the differences in zines and blogs, the folks I interviewed talked about the really negative, I know you've experienced this, the really negative kind of comments that you will often get on a blog. And research, the Pew Center has done research on this and has shown that, girls and women, or people who are perceived as girls and women, often receive more negative comments on their blog than people who are perceived as men. So in some ways, blogging can be, maybe it's overstating to say a dangerous space, but a hostile space for girls and women. And apparently that just does not happen with zines at all. In part because I think if you're going to, you know, if you read somebody's zine and then you have something to say, you have to actually sit down and write a letter usually, which then nobody else is going to read except for the person that you're sending it to. Whereas with a blog, you know, I mean, any idiot can sit down and in 2 seconds write an anonymous, awful comment that then, you know, they, I guess, have the pleasure of thinking that lots of other people will read. So there's not that same kind of hostility, by and large, with zines. And I talk in the book about how I think the physicality of zines, the materiality of them, has an impact on what they mean, on how they communicate. And I talk about, I have this concept of embodied community, that zines kind of connects people almost physically in a way that blogs don't. And I talk about how, you know, you can smell somebody's house when they send you paper, you know, if it's a letter or a zine. And so there is a kind of physical connection. And the folks that I talk to, I talk to a number of zine readers too, and they, you know, they affirmed that. So I do think that there are meaningful differences between blogs and zines, although obviously in some ways they're very similar.
Well, and it seems to me too that a lot of at least big feminist bloggers view themselves as like crosses between journalists and pundits, whereas zines are just self-expression.
No, that's right. That's right. Exactly. I mean, I can't think of really any zines that were imagining themselves as journalism.
So I guess the final question here is, like, how much impact do you think that zines had on what we think of as third wave feminism?
I think they were really important to, the sort of creation of the concept of the third wave. And that's, I talk about in the first chapter of the book, I talk about the fact that there is this feminist history of zines that people often say that zines are inheritors of, you know, the punk movement, and also they'll say that the pamphleteers with the American Revolution and, you know, Samizdat publications and all these things were the forerunners of zines, but that in fact there's this whole feminist history of zines. There are a bunch of feminist forerunners that nobody talks about. And so I think it's important to recognize that there's a feminist, female and feminist lineage for zines. And so then zines happened, emerged, you know, Action Girl newsletter, the Riot Girl zines, emerged at the same moment that the third wave was kind of being conceptualized in the early 1990s. And Toby Vail, who was a Riot Girl zine creator, said, you know, that she said, I'm not sure if we created the third wave, but there wasn't a concept of the third wave when we started producing the Jigsaw zine. And so she said, you know, I think maybe we had a hand in creating it. And I think that that's right. I mean, I think that, this, you know, kind of critical mass of, you know, Riot Girl was more than zines, and so I think Riot Girl itself was very foundational to the third wave. But the Riot Girl music, the Riot Girl zines, Action Girl newsletter, I mean, helped to radicalize a lot of girls and women and helped to create this concept that, you know, that there is kind of a new feminism. There was a new feminism emerging in the early 1990s. And the books that started kind of explaining and conceptualizing the third wave didn't come about until, you know, 95, 96, that first wave of, you know, To Be Real and Listen Up and those anthologies. But the zines were being produced much earlier than that. So I really do see them as being, you know, yeah, kind of catalysts or initiators for what we now call third wave feminism.
My guest today has been Allison Pipmeyer, and her book is Girl Zines, Making Media, Doing Feminism. It's published by NYU Press and available online and at local bookstores. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Allison.
Thanks so much for having me. This was fun.
Now listen up. Now gather around. Now listen.
I thought there would be a small chance that I would be able, especially due to the holiday, to avoid doing a segment addressing the baffling controversy over Tiger Woods' infidelities. And I say baffling because I simply cannot and will not believe that anyone is genuinely shocked that a world-famous athlete who has people singing his praises all day and night might have both the opportunities to cheat and the entitlement issues to do it. Since I refuse to believe anyone is reacting out of genuine shock or moral outrage, I'm forced to conclude that the whole controversy is being conducted for the same reason any disingenuous sex stuff gets into the public consciousness, which is that it's an excuse for the right to start pushing their agenda on the public. Luckily for my theory, it was neatly proven true by Fox News pundit Britt Hume, who decided this was a good time to make a strike for Christian dominance.
I think he's lost his family. It's not clear to me that whether he'll be able to have a relationship with his children. But the Tiger Woods that emerges once the news value dies out of this scandal, the extent to which he can recover, it seems to me, depends on his faith. He's said to be a Buddhist. I don't think that faith offers the kind of forgiveness and redemption that is offered by the Christian faith. So my message to Tiger would be, Tiger, turn to the Christian faith, and you can make a total recovery and be a great example to the world.
Of course, there's no reason to think that non-Christians have no idea of what it means to seek self-betterment or redemption, or to think that Christians are exempt from doing hurtful things. In fact, Don Imus actually took it upon himself to correct Hume's assumption, even while blowing smoke up his ass about how he's so great, blah, blah.
Well, we checked this morning, and unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, if you are a Buddhist, there is a path to recovery and redemption, right? Well, yes, there is. The idea of redemption and nirvana under Buddhism is achieving the state of being freed from greed, hate, and delusion. It's done by observing the rules of the four benevolent insights and benevolent eightfold track. I used to have one of those.
What I think was interesting about this whole thing is that Hume, by rushing forward with this nonsense, really revealed something about the American religious right that they might otherwise take pains to conceal. And it's this. They seem to think that sex is their property. Or to be more specific, that sexual sin is. The idea that Buddhists are just dandy with cheating on your wife is a weird assumption, but if you think about where Hume is coming from, it makes sense. This, in turn, should tell you something else. The right isn't interested in controlling sexuality because of babies or family values, per se, but you already knew that. Nor does it have much to do with life. But it does have everything to do with social control and dominance, and part of that agenda is asserting that Christianity is, if not an official state religion, a de facto state religion. And sex is just a tool they use as part of that agenda. The much-touted hostility to secularism is fundamentally a hostility to diversity, since, after all, true respect for a diverse population would mean not singling out one belief system as dominant in the public square. But they can't come right out and say this, so instead they lean on sexual hysteria and judgments to smuggle that message in. which is why Hume got support from some interesting characters, like Pat Buchanan.
Well, I consider myself a friend of Rich Hume, and I think he was being candid and honest, and I don't know what the Buddhist religion is, but there's no doubt that Christianity is a religion of mercy and forgiveness, and it's conditional, of course, upon people altering their life and being sorry for what they've done. And I'm not a spiritual advisor to Tiger Woods, but...
But would you ever volunteer that without being asked? I mean, it just seems...
He went on to disassemble some more, suggesting that at best this was Hume being impolite instead of being a real meathead. But Buchanan supported the idea of shaming Woods for his religion and suggesting that all Buddhists everywhere are big old fans of adultery, and that it was fine to do this without knowing the first thing about Buddhism. Look, I'm no expert on world religions, but any fool could tell you that it's unlikely that a major religion is going to really valorize disruptive behavior like adultery. Of course, these two clowns probably don't realize Buddhism is a major religion. Like I said, what should be clear is this. The Christian right has decided that sex is their gateway to push their other ideas, especially their hostility to diversity and religious freedom. When it comes to female sexuality, people have enough guilt and sexism to be unable to see this. But now that it's a very wealthy man whose sexual dalliances are being used as an excuse to attack him for being different, I hope people see this. The Daily Show certainly did.
You rarely see a news commentator make the point that one religion is superior to another. Well, ever since they canceled David Brinkley's The David Brinkley Lutherans Are Doomed Sissies report. But the question is Mr. Hume's assertion that Christianity is more redemptive than Buddhism and the implication being all other religions an appropriate comment? For answers, we go to the best theological team on the planet. Wyatt Cenac, Samantha Bee, and Asif Manvi. Nice to see you guys. Happy New Year. We're going to start with Wyatt Cenac. Wyatt, is this appropriate?
Absolutely. I mean, different religions offer different benefits. Or to put it in terms Tiger Woods would understand, you don't use a driver to get out of a sand trap. Look, by converting to Christianity, he gives himself a chance at redemption in this life and the next one. If Tiger Woods were to stay with Buddhism, well, with all the that dude's pulled, he's coming back as like a dung beetle or maybe peat moss. Ooh, or that stuff you find in your shower grout, like that the scrubbing bubbles go after.
And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. But you just said, oh wait, you were full of it edition. Scott Lively, who was one of the organizers of the anti-gay rally that set off Ugandan legislators to write a law that could punish homosexuality by death, is running around claiming that he didn't want it to happen that way. But it's hard to believe him when he says stuff like this.
Did you say at the end of the last segment, Reverend, that what Uganda is doing is a step in the right direction? Could you clarify that?
Yes, I believe it is a step in the right direction. Uganda is one of the few countries in the world today that are actively discouraging the mainstreaming of homosexuality in their...
Yeah, so there you go. I fail to see how Uganda could step much further in the direction Lively wants. What can you do worse than killing people? Desecrating their corpses? The good news is that the wingnuts who supported this murderous legislation aren't being able to run from it like they'd like, and their true ugly selves are coming out.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.